just to finish up with some of the ideas I was discussing at the end of the last session. You see, the question becomes, how do you avoid these two poles of collectivism and individualism? Because the only remedy for individualism seems to be collectivism, and the only remedy for collectivism seems to be individualism. But again, this is sort of like on a horizontal sliding scale. Every society can be situated somewhere between the poles of pure collectivism and pure individualism. So again, the answer, I believe, lies in the notion of intrinsic value. In other words, we have to realize that we don't have to seek our value because we already have it. It comes from God. In other words, this is the material world and the spiritual world. Now, let's just say a few words about this. The Baha'i writings tell us that the principle of existence in the material world is one of composition. All material entities are composed of elements or parts. Then the principle of existence in the spiritual world is that entities exist as undivided wholes. So the soul of man exists as an undivided soul. It has no parts to it. So the profile existence in the material world is that entities have a finite beginning and a finite end. Abdu'l-Bahá expresses this. This is from this article, The Causality Principle in the World of Being, that the quotations are mostly from Paris Talks and from Some Answered Questions. So this is on page 115. People have asked me to mention the page that I'm quoting from.
They will be here this evening.
Good. Good. The books. The whole physical creation is perishable. These material bodies are composed of atoms. When these atoms begin to separate, decomposition sets in. Then comes what we call death. This composition of atoms, which constitutes the body or mortal element of any created being, is temporary. When the power of attraction, which holds these atoms together, is withdrawn, the body as such ceases to exist. Absolute repose does not exist in nature. All things either make progress or lose ground. Everything moves forward or backward. Nothing is without motion. From his birth, a man progresses physically, we're talking about the physical reality, until he reaches maturity. Then, having arrived at the prime of his life, he begins to decline, the strength and powers of all of his body decrease, and he gradually arrives at the point of death. All material things progress to a certain point, then begin to decline. So this is the pattern of all things material. They have a finite beginning and a finite end. Material entities exist when the particular configuration which constitutes them comes into being, and it endures for a certain time, and then when decomposition occurs, as Abdu'l-Bahá says, then the body no longer exists, the entity no longer exists. And of course, during this time, it goes through a certain evolution. Again, I draw this parabola, this inverted parabola that is this arc of ascending and descending that characterizes everything physical. Spiritual entities exist as undivided wholes. And since, as Abdu'l Baha says, death, what we call death, is decomposition, then spiritual entities cannot die. They are immortal. In particular, the soul of man cannot die. However, it did not always exist. So the soul, in particular, of the human being has a beginning, but no end. We are told in the writings that the soul of man is created at the moment of physical conception. The House of Justice has said that we don't know exactly what is the moment of physical conception. In other words, is it the moment that the sperm penetrates the egg or whatever? We don't know. But whenever this moment is the moment that the soul is created. And then we have the world of God, which has neither beginning nor end. Now, of course, the world of man can be subdivided into two sub-worlds or two levels, which is the manifestations who are created in a state of perfection, and the ordinary human beings who are created in an imperfect state but with the potential for perfection. So God is eternally unchanged, unchanged in the beginning, unchanged in the end. Already Plato gave a two-sentence logical proof that God is unchanging. He said, God is perfect. Any change from a perfect state must be towards a less perfect state. Since God is perfect, he cannot change. End of argument.
What was the last
word? A change means a change from one state to another state. If God is in a perfect state, then if he changes from a perfect state, it must be to a different state, which must therefore be imperfect, since he is in a perfect state. Therefore, God does not change, since he is always perfect. Okay? Abdu'l Baha gives the same argument, but Plato already gave it 2,000 years ago. So God is absolutely forever unchangeable. Physical entities have a finite beginning and a finite end. The souls of the manifestations are not eternally pre-existent. They are created at a certain point. However, they pre-exist their spiritual lives. This we are told in the writings. What?
Did you mean physical life?
Yeah.
They pre-exist their physical life?
Yeah. The soul of the manifestation pre-exists in the spiritual world. In fact, the other levels of reality below the manifestation are created through the manifestations. And there are an infinite number of manifestations. Each manifestation is a perfect representative of God. In other words, to know any manifestation is to know God. So the manifestation is created in a perfect state of being. So he also does not change. Perfect on his level. Now remember, Abdu'l Baha explains that something can be perfect on its level of being, but imperfect with respect to another level of being. So the manifestation does not share in God's eternal pre-existence. God has always existed. A given manifestation has not always existed. There was a time when Baha'u'llah did not exist. There was a time when Jesus Christ did not exist. But at some point, God created the soul of Baha'u'llah, And as with all manifestations, the soul was created in a state of perfection, like a pure and perfect mirror, which instantly and completely reflects God. And so, this, of course, goes on in the spiritual world. Now, the body of man, the human body, is a physical entity composed of elements, and so it has the typical profile of a material entity, that is, it has a finite beginning and a finite end. The soul of ordinary humans, our souls, are spiritual entities, and so they are part of the spiritual world. This is an absolute line here. There is no, there, as Abdu'l-Bahá says, the soul of man is completely out of the order of the physical world. So we can't, we should not think of the soul as something like energy or pure energy or something like this, because Einstein's equation says there's intercontrovertibility between matter and energy. So the purest energy, physical energy you can think of, is still just another form of matter. It's still the material world. So the soul is above all of that. It is, as Abdu'l-Bahá says, entirely out of the order of the physical creation. It is not a physical entity. It is created, it comes from God, and from the moment of its creation, it begins to evolve. And it evolves towards the state of perfection in which the manifestation is created. So, these are the four levels of creation that are mentioned in the Baha'i writings. These are the four, what we would call in philosophy, ontological levels. That is, there are distinctions of kind and there are distinctions of degree. There are two kinds of distinctions. So, the difference between a wild dog and a domesticated, say, seeing eye dog is a difference of degree or kind. Which? Degree. They're both dogs. They're both on the same level of being, but what an immense difference of degree, okay? One dog is a helper of humanity, the other is a wild beast. But they're still beasts, they're still animals. So that's a difference of degree. The difference between a human being and a dog is a degree of kind. No dog, however domesticated, can ever be a human being, and so on.
Hard to imagine Gemma as a wild beast.
Right, right. Well, in any case. So these are the four levels. In other words, God is alone on his level of existence. The manifestation is on a level of existence that is distinct. All manifestations are on the same level of existence, all the manifestations. And the human being constitutes a level of existence intermediary between below the manifestation, but is, his soul is totally outside the material world. So these are the four levels. Now there are differences of degree on the in each of these levels, okay? In other words, in the material world there are differences of degree, like the dogs I was just talking about, or like when Abdu'l-Bahá gives the example of the mineral spirit, the vegetable spirit, the animal spirit. These are different degrees of existence in the material world, but they still are part of the material world. They're on the same ontological level. Now, Abdu'l-Bahá explains that there is no progression in the material world. There is no progression that is not followed ultimately by retrogression. There is no absolute progress in the material world. The whole of the material world represents periodic motion, that is, constant motion within fixed limits. So this is just like this parabola that if you put a bunch of them together, if you have a number of these cycles going on together, what you get is this. Okay? So you have your body now, but within 100 years, let's make it easy, it will not be here, it will be dispersed, but maybe the atoms that are in your body now will be part of somebody else's body, you know, and so on and so on. And so this configuration that is you will go through cycles and so on, but there is no progression in the material world that is not followed by retrogression. As Abdu'l-Bahá says, the material world does not have in itself the capacity of progress. All things that we call progress is an expression of spirit in the material world. The very notion of matter, the measure of matter is mass. What is mass? Mass is defined as inertia, as resistance to change. So matter is a resistance against which or upon which spirit acts. So matter in itself has no capacity for progress or change. Matter is in its very, the essence of matter is to resist change. The more matter you have, you cannot produce change by increasing matter. Because if you increase matter, you amass, you increase the resistance to change. So this is one reason why we should not amass riches. Because if we amass riches, we are literally increasing our resistance to spiritual transformation. That's literally what we're doing. We are creating a greater resistance against which we have to struggle. Now, of course, when we have financial difficulties, we may think that that would be preferable. But nonetheless, this is what we're told in the writings. So the point is then that these fluctuations in the material world are due to the tension of opposites. And this tension of opposites is the result of the action of the spiritual world on the material world. So in the spiritual world, there is no tension of opposites. In the spiritual world, the only movement is towards God. There are no opposing forces. Let me read you this, where this is quite clear from the writings. There are numerous statements which make this quite clear. In the world of spirit, there is no retrogression. This is Abdu'l-Bahá, page 119. The world of mortality is a world of contradictions, of opposites. Motion being compulsory, everything must either go forward or retreat. In the realm of spirit, there is no retreat possible. All movement is bound to be towards a perfect state. Progress is the expression of spirit in the world of matter. The intelligence of man, his reasoning powers, his knowledge, his scientific achievements, all these being manifestations of the spirit, partake of the inevitable law of spiritual progress and are therefore of necessity immortal. Now let us consider the soul. We have seen that movement is essential to existence. Nothing that has life is without motion. All creation, whether mineral, vegetable, or animal, is compelled to obey the law of motion. It must either ascend or descend. But with the human soul, there is no decline. Its only movement is towards perfection. Growth and progress alone constitute the motion of the soul. Divine perfection is infinite, therefore the progress of the soul is also infinite. Now, of course, this means after the soul is released from the body, as is clear from the context, okay? In other words, in this life, if we do not make sufficient spiritual progress, we can retrogress in this life. This is quite clear from the writings, and the example of covenant breakers and so on makes it quite clear. In fact, Shoghi Effendi in one place says, life is a constant struggle, not only against the forces of life, but against our own egos. And if we cease, he says, it's like rowing upstream, and if we cease for even a moment to make an effort, we will soon see that we are carried downstream by these forces. So, as I say, these material forces are like a resistance, but if we don't struggle against this resistance, then these forces can build up against the spiritual forces which we are deploying inadequately, and we can retrogress in this life. Yes?
But here it said that you can't, like spiritually, you can't go back. You can only progress forward.
As I say, from the context that's quite clear, that is referring to once the soul is released from the body. You see, in the first passage, you see, one has to put these in context. Otherwise, you just go around in circles. In the world of spirit, there is no retrogression. The world of mortality is a world of contradictions, of opposites. Motion being compulsory, everything must go forward or retreat. In the realm of spirit, there is no retreat possible. In the realm of spirit, as long as we have bodies attached to our souls, we're not in the realm of spirit. Our souls are in the realm of spirit, but ourselves have this bodily aspect, which is also in the material world. And therefore, as long as we're bound to the material world, we're subject to the laws of the material world and the law of progression and retrogression. Okay? Yes, he says the world of mortality is a world of contradictions, of opposites. Motion being compulsory, everything must go forward or retreat. Progress is the expression of spirit in the world of matter.
It's often occurred to me whenever you look at the writings, you're always looking and seeing the paradoxes, the opposites, and in some ways, in our limited ways of understanding, we sometimes wonder how can you put together complete love and complete frankness, for example. And there's millions of examples of it, and that's interesting to me, that our world that we live in is a world of contradictions and opposites, and the spiritual world
is not.
It's only a progression.
That's right. And you see, what has come out of modern science is also the following thing, you see, that there can be no, we know this for a fact, it's these various incompleteness principles like Heisenberg incompleteness or Gödel incompleteness in mathematics, there can be no exact rational description of the totality of reality that we know. For fact now, science has proved this. There does not exist any finite, let's say, okay, rational, exact description of the whole of reality. So this is why the language of revelation is a poetic language or an imagistic language. Because the purpose of the language of science is to give an exact description of a part of reality. And the purpose of language of revelation is to give a description of the whole of reality. And since there is no rational, exact description of the whole of reality, then the prophet uses poetic language, imagistic languages with tensions of opposites and contradictory images, which if we take them out of context, you know, we get confused. And so on and so on, because he is giving a language which has the capacity to describe the whole of reality. And what does this mean practically? This means that whatever problem you can counter, whatever problem it is possible for any human being to encounter, is answered in the writings somewhere. You can't say that for any scientific theory, okay? Even the best scientific theory, you can say, this theory tells us exactly what is going to happen under certain circumstances. But if you say, does this theory have an answer for every problem that will ever come up? Well, absolutely not. Because the theory, you see, is an exact description of a certain part of reality. And scientists talk jokingly about the theory of everything. You know, they sort of make fun of this notion, and when scientists come up with very speculative theories, they're made fun of as trying to make a theory of everything. because scientists now know. I mean, we know from these undecidable principles like Heisenberg's and Gödel's and so on, that this isn't possible. I mean, even in principle. So science is bottom up. Science is bottom up. It starts by observation and it goes up towards an abstract description of a larger and larger portions of reality. And religion is top down. It starts with a global description of the whole of reality and it comes down. So that's why you need both religion and science. You can't do with just one. And incidentally, that's a very important point, is that from the Baha'i point of view, science is just as important for the spiritual development of the human being as is religion. So some Baha'is seem to feel that religion alone is sufficient, but this isn't what the Baha'i faith teaches. So the unity of religion and science, as taught in the Baha'i faith, is not just the notion that religion doesn't contradict science, but that science is from God. Science is, if you will, one of the two God-ordained sources of revelation, of true knowledge of reality. Well, let me read to you the way Abdu'l-Bahá says it. Know then that those mathematical questions which have stood the test of scrutiny, and about the soundness of which there is no doubt, are those that are supported by incontrovertible and logically binding proofs and by the rules of geometry as applied to astronomy. So that's one place where it's absolutely clear. He says, these are questions about which there is no doubt. Infallible, if you want to say. Okay? Well, again, we've known this in mathematics for about the last 100 years. Again, this is a development since Baha'u'llah has come, interestingly enough. This is the whole basis of computers, that mathematical knowledge is so absolute that we can even program a mechanical device to grind it out, okay? An unthinking, unfeeling device can do it because... So, mathematical knowledge is very certain knowledge, but about a very limited part of reality, okay? So, science alone, one could turn it around and say, well, why do we need religion? If science actually gives us infallible knowledge, why isn't that good enough? Well, the point is that it gives us infallible knowledge, but not adequate knowledge. It doesn't give us knowledge that we need to satisfy our needs, to make spiritual progress, to satisfy the purpose of our existence. So science alone is not enough either. But religion alone is not enough either, because God has ordained it that way. I mean, if God had wanted us to be able to heal ourselves of diseases by prayer, he could have done that. But he didn't. He ordained medical science. And he has all sorts of spiritual reasons for this. This creates certain kinds of links between human beings. It means that he wants us all to have the experience of being vulnerable and dependent on other people, as well as being in a position to serve and to help others who are weaker, rather than seeking to dominate them. So he has all sorts of purposes in having divided up knowledge into science and religion. He could have made it either way. He could have made it either way. So in fact, there is only knowledge. There's only truth, and there's reality, and there's knowledge of reality. So what you call science and what you call religion is really, to a certain extent, arbitrary. But the processes are different. One is the process of a bottom-up process of building models based on our perceptions of reality, and carefully testing the models in the whole scientific process. And the other is revelation, is a top-down process in which the language of the prophet gives, as I say, a complete description of reality. And I'm not making this up. Shoghi Effendi said, The writings contain an answer to every human problem. And if the Baha'is have not found the answer to a given problem, it is only because they have not been able to ask the right questions and found the part of the writings which contains this answer. He also said that the faith is perfect. So the Baha'i faith is perfect, and that any imperfection that we think we see in the faith comes from ourselves and not from the faith itself. Just as I said this morning, that love, like gravity, is the source of attraction. Love is the source of happiness. So if we are unhappy, it's not because we love. We may be unhappy in spite of the fact that we love to some extent, but love itself cannot be the source of unhappiness, because the nature of love is to produce happiness. So, what we have is one reality. We have two God-ordained sources of trustworthy knowledge of this reality. One is science and the other is religion. Science gives us exact knowledge of portions of reality. Religion gives us a comprehensive knowledge of all of reality. And it is by putting these two together that we can get exact knowledge of any given portion of reality. In other words, by a scientific study of the writings, we can therefore evolve an exact answer to any given problem. But of course, we will never have the God's eye view of the whole thing, because only God has that. Okay, so this, I offer these symbols. This is a symbolic way that I represent, just in my own mind, the four levels of existence. Of, if you will, well, there's two ways. You can use the double arrow here, the constant single arrow, the evolving arrow, and this, or I do this, to remind myself of the dynamics of the material world is continual movement within fixed limits. You see, this is the universal law of material world, is periodic motion, constant motion within fixed limits. It's the beating of your heart, the waves of your brain I talked about this morning, the motion of the planets around the sun. The whole of reality is waves, is periodic motion, wave-like motion. This is the only way, and a very clever way, that God has found to unite two things together, namely dynamism, that is change, constant change, and stability. You see, change without stability gives you an exponential catastrophe. Stability without change is just a good definition of death, right? So the only way you can have both dynamism and stability is periodic motion, and that's what every material thing does. You see, so for example, as Abdu'l-Bahá says, the health of your body depends on the exact proportion of the various elements that constitute your body. Disease supervenes, as he says, when there is a disturbance in this proportion, okay? When there's an excess or deficiency of a certain element. But even though the levels of these elements in your body may be constant, there's actually a dynamic process going on in which they're being converted into each other continually. So this is a dynamic process, but one which is stable, like the earth turning on its axis. You see, he says the Muslim philosophers puzzled over the Quranic statement that the sun moves constantly in a fixed place. How could it move in a fixed place? If it's moving, it's not fixed. If it's fixed, it's not moving. Well, it turns on its axis, you see, because it has perfect symmetry. You see, there, a sphere or a circle has this symmetry, you see. A circle could turn infinitely on itself without leaving its boundaries, you see. if a circle was turning on itself, you couldn't tell that it was turning. It would be fixed in the same position. So this is why the circle has always been a symbol of infinity. The other symbol of infinity, of course, is a line. But the circle is like a complete symbol of infinity because it's like the line that closes on itself. So in the same way, in three dimensions, the sphere is perfect. It has this perfect symmetry. It can turn on its axis, it can turn on itself, and stay in the same place at the same time, just like the circle. And then, when Baha'u'llah talks about the soul, he says, it is still, and yet it moves. It is still, and yet it moves. Well, it's the same thing, you see. It is dynamic, even though it may stay in the same place. So this is the law of the material world, is continual motion within fixed limits. So the writings tell us then that the only thing in creation that progresses is the soul of the human being. The only thing in creation that has irreversible progress is the human being. God does not progress because he doesn't change. He doesn't have to progress. The manifestation is perfect on his level of existence, okay? The manifestation does not progress either because the manifestation is created in a perfect state of existence. The human world does not, the material world does not progress because every progression is followed by retrogression, because the law of the material world is continual motion within fixed limits, periodic motion. But with the human soul, there is irreversible progress. There is irreversible progress. We just read, once the soul leaves the body, there is no retreat. It progresses from whatever condition it enters the spiritual world, and its progress is towards God. Now, there's two things to say about this. First, this progression is not automatic. And second, the rate of progression depends on the spiritual maturity of the individual. And so, and as Abdu'l-Bahá says, even though you cannot retrogress absolutely, if others are progressing faster than you, then relative to them, you are retrogressing. So in this relative, the experience of retrogression is still possible in the next life, except that there is no absolute retrogression. You cannot retrogress in the way that you can in this life. Now, what this means, of course, is that this world is a special environment in which we learn. And the condition of this environment is what I talked about this morning, suffering. You see, this condition does not exist in the next life. So, in the next life, as Abdu'l-Bahá has explicitly said, the tests and sufferings do not exist in the next life. The spiritual world, as he says, can give only happiness. All unhappiness comes from one form or another of attachment to the material world. The spiritual world cannot give unhappiness. But there's a trade-off. The trade-off is that you don't progress as fast in the next life, okay? You don't progress as fast. You don't have the tests, but you don't have the opportunities either. So, rather than being looked at as a veil of tears, which it undoubtedly is, this life could also be seen, and more correctly seen, as a unique opportunity. It's an opportunity to get a jump start on humanity, on eternity, okay? That's what it is. It's a jump start to eternity because it enables us, by struggling against this resistance, which is the material world, we can make immense amounts of spiritual progress in a very short period of time. And that's the purpose of this life. This life is the womb for the next life, as Abdu'l-Bahá says. Now, the womb, in 9 months, the individual recapitulates 500,000 years, I'm sorry, 500 million years, a half a billion years of evolution. All right, from one cell organism to a complete human being. Outside the womb of the mother, this process took 500 million years. Inside, with the special conditions of the womb of the mother, it takes only 9 months. So the special conditions of the womb of the mother enable 500 million years of evolution to take place in 9 months. In the same way, we can say that the special conditions of this material world enable us to make, compress an immense quantum of spiritual progress in the short span of a physical human lifetime. So that is the great opportunity of this life. But there's a difference, namely that the progress in the womb of the mother is automatic, whereas our spiritual progress depends on the efforts that we make. So there is a similarity, but there is a difference. There's this one little difference. Now, of course, even though the process of development in the womb of the mother is unconscious, that is, it's not through the efforts of the baby or the fetus that it grows, it's unconscious, nonetheless, it needs knowledge of how to use the special conditions of the womb. If you don't believe it, put a rock or something else in the womb of the mother and see if it develops in 9 months into a mature human being. It doesn't. Or put a fertilized pig embryo or something in the womb of the mother and see if it develops into a mature human being. It doesn't. So what is this knowledge that the fetus has? Where does it get this knowledge? Well, this is what we call the DNA, right? That is, the experience of 500 million years of evolution, the knowledge of how to accomplish this evolution is encoded in the DNA, and this manual tells the cell how to use the special conditions in the womb of the mother in order to recapitulate this evolution in 9 months. Now, what is the spiritual counterpart to the genetic code? What is it?
The revelation.
The teachings of the manifestations. The reality of how to progress spiritually is encoded in the language of the holy books. And by using this knowledge to avail ourselves of the special conditions of this material world, we can progress spiritually. So you see, when Shoghi Effendi says that this world is a womb for the next world, he's speaking with exact scientific precision. This is not a loose analogy.